Case number 21-5028, Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, Appellants versus United States Department of Homeland Security et al. Mr. Miano for the appellant, Mr. Press for the government appellees, Mr. Hughes for the association appellees.
Mr. Miano, thank goodness we can see you.
Thank you. We've had some technical problems. The building has basically lost its internet, so I'm sorry we're having to do it with the phone. We may lose the video.
Okay. Well, we can hear you. So
thank
please
you,
proceed. Okay. Please proceed.
May it please the court. The statute at issue of this appeal is very clear. In fact, it is so clear that until now, it has never suffered from conflicting opinions in the courts. The student visa authorizes admission of bona fide students solely to pursue a course of study at an approved academic institution that will report termination of attendance. Those are the requirements for student visa. Yet DHS has disregarded those requirements to transform student visas into the largest guest worker program in the entire immigration system by allowing aliens to work in the United States when they do not conform to those requirements. The regulation at issue is in excess of DHS authority for two reasons. First, it allows aliens to remain in the United States when they're not pursuing a course of study, and it allows aliens to work in the United States while not pursuing a course of study. And the practicable effect of this is that DHS has created its own H-1B program through regulation that circumvents the caps on H-1B visas that protect American workers.
Mr. Miano, could I ask you to just pause for a minute or two and focus on the government's argument that your association lacks standing? If you don't mind, would you focus on that? And maybe you could start by telling me, for you to have standing at the summary judgment stage, you have to show that a member of your association is competing with OTP workers, right, who are not attending school, who are subject to extensions. So could you point the court where in the record that what is your best evidence of that?
Best evidence of that, Your Honor, is one, that this regulation is targeted to the tech industry. So the workers coming in here are specifically targeted to the tech industry. And we have it, so the plaintiff is a union of technology workers.
Right, but under our decision in Mendoza, if you want to make that argument, you have to show that one of your members is, quote, a direct and current competitor whose bottom line may be adversely affected by the challenge government action. That's a quote from the case. So where is that evidence in the record?
The evidence in the record, Your Honor, is that the workers in question here are working in the tech industry. They're currently active workers. And in the case of Mr. Smith, he's a temporary worker. So it's continuously searching for work. But the standard
Mr. Smith.
He is a temporary worker. The novel argument that the government raised was that now that two of the named members of the association are employed, the government's argument is now that they're no longer competitors. That they're no longer in the industry. The standard for competitive standard is whether the regulation issue allows competition against them. Louisiana Energy, which this court has repeatedly held that a party suffers injury in fact if competition is allowed against them. And in this case, it's not even allowed, it's directed towards them.
Let me ask you to, you know, in response to your in the district court, in the appendix that you filed in support of your motion for summary judgment, you had a very helpful table listing all of the allegations in support of standing. Do you know what document I'm talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so and you have two columns there. You list the allegations. And then the evidence for each one. And as I go through it, next to every one of the allegations, which claim that applications had been made for OPT extensions for workers in companies where your members have applied for jobs. There's 27 of those. It says there's no evidence.
That's 27. I'm to look up here what you're referring to.
I'm looking at your chart where you have. I didn't write down the numbers, but there are 27 different allegations, which claim that applications were made for OPT extensions for workers in companies where your members have applied for or jobs or are working, and each one has this statement that there's no evidence because it's in the hands of the department.
Right, you're right. Okay, now I see what you're talking about. Yes.
Given that we're at summary judgment here, and you have to actually prove standing. You know, we're not at the motion to dismiss stage anymore. What does that table mean to you?
Your Honor, what the difference is here is that we're now talking about specific job losses, and that's a concept this court has repeatedly rejected. You don't have to show specific losses of sales, but rather you have to show that competition is allowed against you. And in this case, you know, we're talking about a program that allows 200,000.
Are you talking about? Are you referring to Mendoza?
No, I'm not referring to Mendoza. I'm referring to like Shirley versus Sebelius. Sebelius, the standard that says the issue isn't lost sales per se. It's the allowance of competition, and so we have more competitors in the market. You add 400,000, you add 200,000 competitors into the technology market, in the U.S. market. You're affecting everyone who's in the market. Now, I mean, in theory, that would, people might say that that's a generalized grievance, but we would flip around and say is that when DHS does something as broad as this, where it's adding as many foreign workers, it injures more workers.
I thought this Mr. Sawade, I'm not sure, Sawade, I thought his affidavit was more concrete. Mr. Miano.
Yes, Your Honor. How the people specify them, what they do. But Mr. Sawade has worked in the tech industry. He's been laid off. He's worked as a temporary worker, and now is back working full time. And all of this has occurred during the course of this litigation. So we're now. So we have these workers who are, you know, they're applying for jobs, they're working for jobs, and these are just representatives of an entire union that represents tech workers.
All right. Judge Tatel, do you, does that answer your questions on standing?
No, but go ahead with
that. Well, I mean,
I don't have any other questions.
All right. Okay. Go ahead.
I had a broader question on standing. I do see the logic of your position that, you know, competitor standing, the premise of it is if in the business to business context, if a regulation eases restrictions on one business, that harms a competitor. And in Mendoza, if immigration law gives a opportunity for people in a field, you know, animal herding, that is going to change the employment prospects of domestic animal herders. And I'm not sure that I see an outer bound, but it is when you get into a field like STEM, which is very diffuse and large and ill-defined, it does seem like the implications of our case law, which of course is on us, are that any working person in the United States would have standing to challenge any immigration law that affords worker permission, that authority to work, to people coming in. And I'm just wondering, that seems like generalized just standing, and whether you have any help for me in thinking that through.
Well, like in the Shays versus FEC case, you know, basically, it said that anyone had standing who was in the in the electoral field, okay? Because a generalized grievance has two parts. One, has to affect a lot of people, and two, it has to be a nebulous injury, okay? Here, we're not dealing with a nebulous industry. Increased competition, the allowance of increased competition, has been treated as a concrete injury by this court consistently. So that basically takes it out of the range of a generalized injury.
Well, and even there, though, Mr. Miano, the brief of the tech companies make a point that I think is economically supported by at least some evidence, which is that certain tech workers may not have a net negative effect on employment, but in fact, a net positive. You know, if you bring in people who have key skills that will allow a business to do something, they may need more workers to come together and accomplish that they couldn't do at all without the kernel of knowledge workers. And, you know, so then it becomes a question of, well, whose burden, and are the, none of that is in the record. But it isn't always clear that adding worker A to the economy depresses opportunity for worker B. And I'm not sure how to think about that.
Well, Your Honor, that concept has been rejected by San Diego Supreme Court, that we don't take benefits, we don't take the benefit to diminish the injury. Plus, we would argue that those study claims are fallacious. I mean, they fly in the face of the basic law of supply and demand. I mean, the problem that we're facing in the tech industry.
I'm sorry, you referred to the Supreme Court case saying we don't take the benefit to diminish. What case are you thinking about?
I can't think of the case right off the bat, but that was the argument that was used in Texas versus the United States in the DACA case, where the defendants argued there was no injury because, you know, for having to provide driver's licenses because they're getting payment. But the courts rejected that because they said there's not a plus or minus. It's like basic trespass law. If someone comes on your property, sees a piece of trash in your property and walks over and picks up the trash, you've still been injured by trespass, even though you've suffered a benefit. But the problem that we're facing in the tech industry is Americans are being displaced. I mean, physically one for one displaced. So what's being told, you know, is it creates this benefit. But when you're working in the industry, for example, Judge Tatel heard one of our cases where we have Americans that have literally been replaced by H-1B workers, by foreign workers being brought in. And these, unfortunately, in the H-1B program, the only protection for American workers under H-1B is limits on the number of workers. So like Disney can go in and take 200.
Were you referring to Save Jobs? Is that the case you were just referring to? But in that case, there was actually evidence that its members had affidavits saying some of them had been fired and replaced by H-1 workers. I mean,
they'd been fired.
Right. You don't have any evidence like that here, right?
No, these people, it's just standard plain vanilla competition where the injury.
But you see, the point Judge Pillard and I are both probing here is that the quote plain vanilla may not work at summary judgment. And I'll just go back to read you. Mendoza says you need direct and current competitor. You have to show that one of your members is a quote direct and current competitor. Direct and current competitor.
All right. And I would point out that in Save Jobs USA, the court says the department overreads our direct and current competitor formulation, which simply distinguishes an existing market participant from a potential and unduly speculative participant, and then goes on to say, we know that these H-1B visa holders have competed with Save Jobs members in the past, and as far as we know, nothing prevents them from doing so in the future. If that's good enough for H-1B, I don't know why it isn't good enough for F-1.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, that's basically our position. But and I'll give you two different. One, in Mendoza, these are people who are just wanted to get into the business. In this case, this is a unit of people actually in the business. I mean, these aren't people who are speculative. These are computer programmers, network people who are actually do it. And getting back to the generalized grievance type thing, I mean, what we have is, suppose DHS does a regulation to import foreign butchers, okay? I mean, theory, only the butchers would have standing to challenge such a regulation. If they then have a regulation for bakers, then only bakers would have regulation. But when they start having butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers, increase the number of fields that are eligible, it seems to me they're increasing the number of people who have standing to challenge it. So if they say, hey, you know, we're just letting tech workers in, which is main part of this extension is tech workers, you would think only tech workers. If they said this regulation could allow anyone, then effectively would send their opening standing to the entire world.
Mr. Biano, you've used up your time, unfortunately, on standing, yeah. But let me give you, since I think you're the only one challenging, I don't think the association is, why don't you take at least 3 minutes to address the merits?
Well, Your Honor, the problem with the merits here is that we have a very clear very clear statute that has never had any problem with interpretation that says that we have to have bona fide students pursuing a course of study at an academic institution. Instead, we have people we're calling students who are working after graduation, have no connection to a university, they're not attending class, they finished their course of study, and DHS has taken it upon itself to create a guest worker program to allow these workers to provide labor. And in fact, the regulation that litigation was explicitly designed to increase the amount of labor by substituting to circumvent the quotas on H-1B visas. And so,
Mr. Brown, in your view, is the graduate who stays in the United States for a couple of months after graduation out of status and deportable the day after graduation?
Your Honor, what you've now hit on, I guess, would be, runs into what Einstein's theory of relativity, that we can't have instantaneous movement. And I think that creates the type of gap that Chevron doesn't even exist. What happens when Congress says, create something that's impossible? So what-
I thought they had 60 days to leave.
But not under the statute, only under the regulation, is that right? And the question is, what's the statutory support for that regulation?
Well, what I would say in that case, and this is, we're getting into theoretical, but Chevron is kind of a one size fits all. And what we have there in the case, what you've described, the statute creates an absolute impossibility for the agency. They can't leave the next day and instantly be gone. So in that case, there's certain discretion. How do I do it? And DHS has said, okay, you can leave at 60 days and you can leave.
But really, I mean, it seems like on your theory, the student who is, you know, that students should be applying for tourist visas for any day that they plan to stay after graduation, and that the rule under your theory, the 60-day rule, is a statutory violation, and that maybe the, you know, Homeland Security will have a prosecutorial policy where it won't go after students. I mean, why would it if they're heading out of town, out of the country? But the rule, the statutory authority for that rule, doesn't that rise and fall on your theory just like the OTP rule would have to rise and fall on your theory?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what you're, unfortunately, in the immigration statute, there are a number of absolute impossibilities that Congress has enacted. I won't go.
But it's not an impossibility. You schedule a flight or get a tourist visa. Why is that a possibility?
Well, you schedule a flight to be in, oh, I've got my degree, we'll move. And I think there's a big difference between giving someone time to actually leave the country, you know, for a modest time, period of time to leave the country is entirely different than allowing to stay for 42 months so they can provide labor to Microsoft.
Well, and as a matter of fact, they are allowed to stay in the summertime between years of study, and they're not necessarily pursuing a course of study. If there are no more questions, then we'll give you a couple minutes in reply, Mr. Miano. Mr. Press.
Thank you, Your Honors. Joshua Press from the Department of Justice here on behalf of the government appellees. Your Honors, we think that this is a simple case for two principal reasons. One is the questioning of Mr. Miano was sort of getting at. The standing questions do linger in this case, and it is different from Judge Tatel's opinion in Save Jobs, simply because at no time have the plaintiffs, or the rather WatchTech's members, actually shown that they were in direct and current competition. We know from Judge Henderson's opinion that, you know, at the motion to dismiss stage, they did have standing because of their allegations that they were still searching for jobs and the complaint. But at the motion for summary judgment stage, as this court has made pretty clear numerous times, including in Humane Society, which we cite to and discuss in our briefing, at the summary judgment stage, the burden is greater upon the plaintiffs, and that's why we made the argument that we did.
Mr. Press, why isn't it enough, as Mr. Biano's briefing asserts, that the people who are in jobs, his members who are in jobs, that presumptively their wages may be depressed by the existence of the program? So it's not just about competition for job openings, it's also about the conditions of the job that one has. If there are people who are eager to get it on weaker terms of, you know, supply and demand, isn't it sort of presumed by the law of economics that they're harmed even if they're employed?
Well, I think that's a good question, Your Honor. I think the problem for that with that argument, though, is that courts don't typically presume things for the purposes of standing. Now, I will admit the law of economics does come into play, and that's why the competitor standing doctrine exists. But I think this court's case law has been pretty clear that that's why there is a need for direct and current competition. If you simply look at the affidavits that were filed by WatchTech's members, they really don't talk about anything that Your Honor's questioning is getting at with respect to depressed wages. They talk about, I've applied for these jobs and I didn't get them. I think the difficulty there, and we're sympathetic to that, but the difficulty is when you're talking about the actions of third parties and their decision-making process as to whether they hired or not someone who interviewed for a job, you're falling directly into the Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife, much more is needed category to bridge that gap and fill that presumption that Your Honor's question is sort of getting at. I mean, with the wages issue, I could just tell you that there's really nothing in the record about that. So it's really all about what Mr. Miano was getting at of, am I being replaced by a foreign student or an international student under the OPT program? There is nothing in the record about any sort of replacement theory as there was in Save Jobs with Judge Tatel's opinion there.
What's the defect in, Mr. Marino mentioned an affidavit by an employee named Saw.
So I think,
what's the defect in that affidavit?
So with Mr. Sawadi's declaration, Sawadi, I think the issue there, no problem. And that's how I hope that I'm pronouncing that correctly. Mr. Miano can certainly correct me if I'm wrong. I think with Mr. Sawadi's declaration in particular, he never actually alleged. I think the last time he got a full-time job was in 2018. And that's it. That's all we know. He started in June 4th of 2018. I think that's at JA page 215 in the appendix. And the problem that we had with that was that when we moved for summary judgment was in about 2 years ago. So it was in fall of 2019. And essentially, we had not heard of anything about Mr. Sawadi's employment search or career path or anything like that for over a year at that point. And so we thought, well, that doesn't actually get at current competition. That's past injury. And because the words are direct and current, as Your Honor was pointing out before, that places an emphasis on the present tense, not future tense or past tense, perhaps immediate future for purposes of typical standing analysis. But there's nothing in the record about presently he was being affected or that he was actually looking for a job.
Finish.
Mr. Miano might sort of, and he has in previous iterations of this litigation sort of argued, well, in our complaint, we say that our job search is constant. But I think the problem with that argument, as Judge Pillard was getting at, was that when you're sort of opening that up to, I'm competing with literally everyone in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics field, that is extremely similar to taxpayer standing. Because what we're really saying is, as long as someone wants to get a job and foreign students or international personnel might come in and take a job, therefore I have standing to challenge that entire immigration
right. Judge Henderson.
All right. And why haven't we said precisely that in Save Jobs USA when we've said, in this case, we know that H-1B visa holders, you can substitute F-1, have competed with Save Jobs members in the past. And as far as we know, nothing prevents them from doing so in the future. And the language about, in the same case, the department overreads our direct and current competitor formulation.
So I think that that is a good question. It's interesting because there's sort of an echo effect between this case and that case. And because that case does cite, I think, your Honor's opinion from WashTec at the motion to dismiss phase. I think the distinction truly is that there was already evidence in the record at the summary judgment phase in Save Jobs of direct job loss by one of the competitors. And I think that's sort of the problem here is we have no evidence of anything like that. It's much more diffuse. And second, there is no evidence that they're currently still looking for a job. And
I was just going to say, I think the standing issues are kind of a problem of our creation, and we will have to address them. But I'm interested in your position on the merits.
Yes.
How typical are you defend this provision on the ground that it is the seeks to enter language means that the conditions of these visas are assessed at the outset, and that after that it's sort of up to the to DHS to put conditions and both of time and activity. How many other provisions are in the seeks to enter form, and would the effects of your position be limited just to those?
I think that I'll try to answer the first question. I don't actually know the number of definitions that sort of use that language. It's really alphabet soup when it comes to the different status and categories of visas that foreign nationals can choose to pursue. I do think that, if you look at just a typical example, a B visitor, they're seeking to enter, for a temporary period of time for pleasure or temporary business purpose or something along those of that nature. There's language that specifically bars them from working when they're trying to get into that category. I think the reason why we were making that argument that this is going to admissibility determinations is because, number one, when a foreign national needs to get an F-1 visa, they have to go to the State Department in a consulate, and they have to show, hey, I'm enrolled at this university or at this school, and I want to take these types of classes. And they have to prove to the consulate that they really are going to be a bona fide student. Then they have to come in to a port of entry, and they have to talk to a CBP Border Patrol or Customs and Border Protection officer at an airport or something like that, and say, I've got the visa that from the consular officer. Here are my papers from the school. I'm really excited to be here. I want to go to class, et cetera. But once they enter the United States, once they're admitted into the United States, obviously things can change once we're going through college classes. I mean, I don't think it's unusual for college students, for example, to change their majors or to change what they're interested in or their pursuits while they're attending classes. And as part of that, things happen once they enter. I can tell you that, and I think the
If a student gets, you know, mono and just says, I'm not going to be able to do well, I need to take a break. Is mm-hmm. there any regulation that defines how a person who drops out or takes time off is dealt with?
Yes. Yeah, so if I might, because I'm probably going to exceed my time, I hope that I can answer your question in full. Very quickly, in that scenario, that came up actually in the 1926 or the 1928 Northern District of California case that we talked about in our brief. Whether he was still, that student was a bona fide student, even though he got sick and had to drop out while working in at a newspaper in San Francisco. And the question was whether he was deportable and whether, you know, we should just leave him, kick him out immediately, as Mr. Miano's position would have it, because he was no longer a student. And the issue there was, no, he was still a bona fide student, and the case law is replete that that's what the term bona fide student means, because there's a good faith intent to continue with the studies. Now, number two, in terms of if they do stop taking classes and they stop pursuing a course of study, at that point, they are out of status, and the regulations do sort of require them to either leave or to resume their studies.
So that statute is very oddly written, and it seems like both sides have some challenges. But under your theory, the statute primarily addresses the student's status at the time that they seek to enter. Do they have to then be a bona fide student? Like reading it the way you do, in fact, reading the literal language, it sounds like an alien who's living, having a residence in a foreign country, who is a bona fide student qualified to pursue a full course of study. So who already is in school of some sort and then is qualified to pursue it and seeks to enter the United States for that purpose. So what if you're not a student and you want to come to the United States on one of these visas? The statute literally read seems to foreclose that.
Well, I think Your Honor is correct that if we read this too literally, it sort of doesn't make a lot of sense in a lot of different circumstances. That's why, to be perfectly candid about this, the statute has never been read so literally as to strangle its meaning. It's always been read functionally to mean that if you are coming here to go to a school and attend classes and to do work study even, and I think the work study stuff is really discussed at length in all the briefings in support of the government's position, then you can come in, we will let you in to pursue that course of study. Obviously, that's supposed to be at a university, but you don't have to attend the university immediately or already be in the university. It's simply having proof that you've been accepted to attend those classes and to start your course of study is adequate.
And there may be some difference between you and Mr. Hughes on this point, but you're not arguing that we can read the statute itself without deference to support your position? You need Chevron step two?
Well, I think we have made that argument implicitly. I know that sounds like a cop-out, but I think that the reason why I say that is because the entire ratification doctrine is really an interpretive doctrine of the statute. And Mr. Hughes's brief and mine really look to the exact same history, in that the point we're making is the statute has always been interpreted this way. Mr. Miano said that Congress never had a problem with interpretation and courts have never had a problem with interpretation. He's absolutely correct about that. And the reason why I know that he's correct about that is because at least since 1947, the statute has always been interpreted to allow for practical training, including practical training after graduation, which it seems is the main beef that Mr. Miano has.
Do we know that at the original adoption of the INA, do we have evidence that before its adoption under the 47 Act, that some of the practical training was post-graduation as opposed to during school? What's your best evidence on that?
So I truly think that the 1950 Senate report discussion, that is really, we get into the guts of it within our brief. I know Mr. Hughes's brief gets into the guts of it as well. That is the best evidence of that, because that is an acknowledgement by the Senate that this is going on after graduation and that we are not changing it at all. We are not changing the language. I mean, honestly, to Your Honor's point, with respect to why the language is written this way, it's because it's vestigial. I mean, it is a lot of this language has been around for basically since 1924. And I know that's not a century, but that's pretty long. That's a pretty long time.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, I was actually going to conclude.
Well, I have a question for you. And that is, considering our precedent from 79, this ANWO versus INS, which interprets this intent of not abandoning the foreign residence as a continuing requirement, what, if anything, do you require the alien to show that he has no intent of abandoning his foreign residence? And is it a continuing showing he makes?
Well, I think that is a good point. I think that determination gets made at the port of entry when someone is being.
And how? With forms or what? An affidavit?
Yes. I think it does. Forms obviously are necessary both with the consular officer when they're approaching a consulate and saying, asking for a visa to allow them to apply for admission in front of CBP. And then again with CBP, and to take your Honor's point to answer your question directly, they have to show, hey, this is my current path. These are the studies that I'm going to be taking. This is how long I'm going to be taking the coursework, or at least presumably, because I think as we all know, sometimes, well, I knew personally that sometimes I take more classes for a longer period of time than I initially set out to take.
Do they swear that they're not abandoning their foreign residence? I'm just trying to find out how you established intent.
Well, so that is a good point. I think honestly, the reason is that that's not a problem is that because there is a presumption built in both before the consular officer and the CBP at any port of entry that the person is trying to come in with an intent to remain here indefinitely.
Well, where does the presumption come from?
Honestly, it comes from the definitional definitions of immigrant versus non-immigrant. The problem with that and why it's quirky is because non-immigrant is not really defined. It's only defined in the negative of someone who's not trying to come in to remain here indefinitely. And so therefore, I know that is extremely frustrating. I apologize. But what I can tell you is the way that this works in practice is that CBP and consular officers always presume when someone is approaching them saying, don't worry, I'm just coming in to see Disneyland and I promise I'll leave immediately after that. The way that they presume and try to deal with this problem that Your Honor is getting at is they say, well, you have to prove to me that you are going to leave. I mean, you can't just say that. I mean, obviously saying that is helpful because we do presume that they're telling the truth. And I don't know if there's an affidavit or any sort of declaration that they have to swear to. I apologize for my lack of knowledge about that specific point, but I do know that they have to show documentation. They have to back that up with some sort of evidence that fits their story. I also know that when they drop out, and this is the other weird thing about the F1 program, is that if they drop out or if they stop attending classes, as Judge Pillard's question was getting at earlier, then the school itself is required to report that within the SEVIS system. It's the Student Exchange Visitor Information System. That's extremely important. Congress really cares about that. That was added in 2002 because, frankly, some people were, some of the September 11th attackers came in under this program and really obviously were not students. And because of that, Congress cared about that and put that onus on the universities to report students who were not complying or were not going to classes because at that point they were out of status. And at that
point, as a policy matter, that makes sense. But Mr. Miano points to that to say, well, doesn't that imply that the statutory test is not applicable only at when the person seeks to enter, but has an ongoing, applies during the entire time the student is here. So he says that the very fact that you're verifying and asking for reporting and, means that the statutory language requires that the person it's not just for the purpose of pursuing such a course of study, but that it is only for the duration of that course of study.
Right, and I know that that's an argument Mr. Miano makes. I think the distinction is that onus is not at all on the international student. The onus is on the universities and programs that subscribe to the F1 program. They are the ones who have to update the database. If we put the onus on the student and it's somebody we don't trust, frankly, I don't understand why we would let them update their status and tell the United States government, oh, don't worry, I am going to class. That's why it's directed to and it regulates not any of the F1 international students, but the universities themselves.
And is that pursuant to the DHS general authority and not pursuant to the F1 authority? Is that where?
Correct.
Okay.
And that is in terms of terms of conditions. And that is sort of, once they enter into that program, the universities or the institutions, this is something that they have to do if they want to remain in that program. For example, the penalty there is not, I mean, the students aren't penalized if the school screws up, at least by the United States government, they're not penalized. It's the schools, and they can they might lose their ability to enroll international students if they do not comply with that provision or do not update CVIS.
All right, any more questions? No. All right, then we'll hear from Mr. Hughes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Paul Hughes for Appalese, the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the Information Technology Industry Council. Post-completion practical training has existed since at least 1947 for 74 years, and we ask the court to emphatically reject WashTec's efforts to have the court end the program. At the bottom, America thrives by attracting international talent to our universities, and DHS was authorized to determine that those students appropriately may complete their studies through limited practical training. We think the way to understand the legal question, the authority here, is to begin with Section 1184A1. That's a very important statute that expressly authorizes the secretary to, quote unquote, prescribe regulations that govern the, quote unquote, time and conditions of a non-immigrant's admission. This is a broad grant of authority to the secretary, which is consistent with the executive's substantial immigration powers. In light of that broad delegation of authority, the question in our view then, is there anything that precludes the secretary from adopting the OPT program? And we think the limitations can be found in two different places and that put guardrails on the secretary's Section 1184A1 power. One would be is if there's a textual preclusion of the conditions that the secretary would seek to implement under Section 1184A1. And we don't think that F1 has any textual preclusion of this program. And I described that. The second is that in exercising the secretary's 1184A1 power to adopt conditions governing the stay of non-immigrants in the United States, those conditions have to be reasonably related to the underlying purposes of the statute the secretary is implementing, including the various visa definitions. And I think that's a very important limitation in this context, because there's no doubt that the secretary has broad powers in this context. And one can think of wild hypotheticals that would suggest a rogue DHS would allow somebody who comes in on a tourist visa to remain in the United States for 50 years and all those sorts of things. But what precludes that is that all of those sorts of wild hypotheticals would not be reasonably related to the underlying purposes. So we think the question—
Mr. Hughes, it seems like the current regulation is done in a better way to meet the kind of nexus with the statute that you're describing, which is describing OPT as part of an educational experience, and that has to be recommended by the schools, and there has to be oversight by the qualifying employers and the like. But the prior iteration of the rule was all about U.S. competitiveness, wasn't it? And would that be supportable under, if that were still the frame and the nature of the rule, would that be supportable? And if not, how do we sort of deal with the pretext issues of that being the first stab and this much more education-oriented rule being the current?
Well, so a few responses to that, Your Honor. First, just as a functional matter, the rule that's currently before the court is the 2016 OPT rule. The challenges to the 2008 rule were found moot, and that's not before the court. The 1992 rule is also not directly before the court. It's only before the court by implication of the 2016 rule. The second point is, as the Supreme Court instructed us in Department of Commerce, looking behind the purposes of the rule would require some sort of extraordinary, exceptional evidence of bad faith or bad intent. And I don't think there's any such evidence or argument that has been made here. So then the question is, well, what is in this rule? And DHS in 2016, as the court indicates, provides a very robust record that is before the court that I think more than sufficiently supports the rule. I think that's consistent with greater scrutiny that courts have provided regulations today than perhaps they had in prior decades. So DHS in promulgating this rule was aware of current judicial approaches and was ensured that it effectively did its homework in extensively documenting how a term-limited practical training program directly relates to the completion of the student's education. And we pointed to extensive parts of the record where DHS makes those findings. I'd also point the court to the evidence that DHS relied on at JA 174, 148, comment letters that say that extensively. As for the duration of the program, the three-year duration, for example, DHS also made very extensive findings that show the reasonableness of why three total years is reasonable. For example, at JA 182, the comment letter of the Society for Human Resources Management says that this is comparable to training programs for postdoctoral students in the three-year period for the National Science Foundation. And other evidence—
But none of those programs are required for non— for American students not requiring visas. They're not part of any educational program for U.S. students.
The purpose,
unlike, for example, internship and residency in medical school.
Well, Your Honor, I think what the DHS was just pointing to is why did they draw the three-year maximum limitation? And they did so because looking to the National Science Foundation grants, PhD programs, and then also there's extensive evidence around J 127, 130, 133, that the life cycle of one project for a STEM student doing an integrated circuit design, for example, is often going to be around 3 years. So to get back to the statutory question, as the court pointed out, it's been uncontroversial that DHS, as part of the regulations, may allow an individual to remain in the United States for up to 60 days post-graduation as part of their F-1 visa. Well, why can they do that? Because it's not inconsistent with the statute as we understand it. And second, it's a reasonable regulation that effectuates the purposes of the statute. For the same reasons, we think OPT is not precluded by the statute and is a reasonable interpretation. You know, second, looking towards
doesn't your reading, though, read out the word solely in the statute? You can quibble about whether it reads out temporarily 3 years, I suppose is temporary, but why doesn't it read out the word solely or the words solely for the purpose of pursuing such a course of study?
Your Honor, because we think that that is appropriately described as the entry requirement. That's what is required.
Well, let's say it isn't. Let's say it isn't. I don't buy that, let's say.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's still some flexibility and understanding of what means to be a student. So let's take, for example, an individual who falls in love and marries somebody and adjusts their status. So they enter the United States as a student, but then they adjust to a K-1 visa following a marriage. That is often permitted and allowable in our immigration system. And that individual, even though the individual who entered solely for one purpose, ultimately had some sort of change at a later point. But Your Honor, the textual language there, who seeks to enter the United States temporarily and solely, truly we think is best understood as the entry requirements. And I agree though, that language is very important because it does put parameters on what is reasonable for DHS to adopt as a regulation. So we think it would be patently unreasonable if DHS were to promulgate a regulation saying somebody who enters with that intent, but a week later decides they don't want to go to school, they'd rather do something else, they drop out, and they're not furthering their education. If DHS were to enact that kind of regulation, we agree that that would be not reasonably related to the underlying purposes of the statute, and that that language that the court is pointing me to certainly defines what is in the range of reasonableness that DHS could adopt in promulgating regulations that further the purposes of the F-1 statute. So I want to be clear, we don't think that that language drops from the equation at all. It is an important part.
I realize that. Are there any more questions? All right. Let's see, Mr. Miano, we've lost you, but I assume you're still on audio. Why don't you take 2 minutes and reply? We must have lost him altogether.
Judge Henderson, Mr. Miano's phone connection has just dropped. I am calling him again.
Okay.
Your Honor, can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Miano, and take 2 minutes in reply.
Okay. Let me just go quickly, Your Honor. First of all, DHS and standing has switched this from allowance of competition to lost sales. So I would point out Bristol-Myers Squibb versus Shalala as showing where this court distinguishes between lost sales as an injury and says that lost sales is not the actual injury, but it's the increased allowance of competition. In regard to the longstanding use of this program, ratification here isn't even applicable because your opinion dismissed the your WASHTEC opinion dismissed all the counts except for excessive authority. So we're talking just excessive authority here. So I mean, ratification is not even applicable. In regard to Section 1184A, we seem to be forgetting the key part. Is 1184A requires DHS's regulations to ensure aliens leave when they do not comply with the status for which they were admitted, and that seems to have completely gone by the wayside. And I would also like to address the wild hypothetical.
But both the government and the intervener emphasize the words seeks to enter the United States. They say that's an entry condition. And if that's right, I realize you may disagree with that, but why is that an unreasonable way to read the statute? Because if that's a reasonable way to read the statute, that solves that problem, doesn't it?
If it were a reasonable way,
okay,
you're
why,
wrong,
tell, problem, me, tell me, tell me why it's unreasonable. To read the statute that way, seeks to enter.
It's because, Your Honor, it's because of 1184A, which says that you have to maintain the status for which you were admitted. And if you were to take that language for any other visa, you could say that all of them are entry requirements. The tourist visa, you don't prohibit those people who enter to perform labor. But if you, they could say, hey, we've entered, and so now we can allow you to work. And this isn't a wild hypothesis either, because the State Department is already doing this. It just has not been challenged yet. Hmm. And I mean, the key thing is that this sets down the visa requirements, and in every court case ever looking at this, at student visas or any non-immigrant visas, have treated the requirements as applying for the alien's entire stay. And there's a huge number of cases dealing with student visas. They're not dealing with question whether of legality of regulations, but they're all treating student visas as the requirements applying from start to finish.
All right. Thank you. Madam Clerk,
thank you,
would
Your
you
Honor.
Call the next case?